Salaam alaikum, brothers and sisters. Every revert I've spoken to has had an amazing story, and any one of us could probably stand up before you and have you spellbound about how Allah brought us to Islam. Mine began in the very unlikely surrounds of an Afghan jail. Some people say it actually started on 9/11. I don't know where you all were that day, but I bet you can remember exactly where you were, who you were with, what you were doing when you heard the news of 9/11. I was in the newsroom of the Sunday Express in London, and I noticed people gathering round a television set. And I said, "Oh, what's happened?" And they said, "Somebody's had a terrible crash and they've hit one of the Twin Towers." And I went up and joined them and looked and watched the flames swallowing one of the Twin Towers. And then the second plane slammed in. And probably like many of you, I realized immediately that this was not an accident. And I'm not sure how you reacted. My reaction as a journalist was to run from the office and get an overnight bag and head for Heathrow. And I spent the next 2 or 3 days in Heathrow waiting for American airspace to clear. America was under siege. It had closed its borders. Nothing was flying into the country. Nothing was flying out. Anyway, I got tickets for the first flight out, and as I made my way to the departure lounge, my boss called me and said, "There's been a change of plan. We want you to go to Pakistan, because that's where the next stage of this story is unfolding." I was furious. All my clothes were for downtown New York. All my contacts had been made for... sorry, I'm being distracted. Right, start again. There were 3,000 journalists there. This is where the main part of the story was unfolding. But there was very little news for us to write about, and many of the journalists were being spoon-fed from the Pentagon and the White House and the Downing Street press office, telling us how evil the Taliban were and how they deserved to be bombed and how they wouldn't hand over Osama bin Laden, and how he was responsible for 9/11. Anyway, there's only so much spoon-feeding you can take, and it's not my style of journalism. And I felt that the real story was in Afghanistan, and I wanted to speak to the real Afghan people to find out about their hopes and fears for this war, what they felt about 9/11, what life was like under the Taliban. I tried 3 times to get a visa to get into Afghanistan, and 3 times the Taliban embassy in Islamabad refused me entry to their country. On top of that, they kicked out all of the Western journalists, which I thought was a really foolish thing to do, because, you know, we've all got opinions about journalists, but we are the eyes and ears, we're witnesses. And by removing all the journalists, what they were able to do was give America and Britain a free hand in committing unreported atrocities during the war. But anyway, I was determined to get in, and so with my guide, Pasha, we developed a plan, and I put on the all-enveloping burqa. I was told I would become invisible, and I really did become invisible as I walked across the no-man's land from Pakistan to Afghanistan. I was with a group of people. We pretended we were part of a wedding party, and I could hear my heart thumping in my ears, and I was sure that the Taliban would pick up on this or hear this noise or smell the fear, but they didn't even give me a cursory glance. I was virtually a non-person. And so we crossed through into Afghanistan and jumped in a taxi and headed for the nearest city, which was Jalalabad. And I sat on the edge of the city and was able to observe life in the marketplace. One of the wonderful thing I thought about the Taliban is that the men did all the shopping. And so I watched, and there were a few women around, but they were in the company of either a husband, a brother, or a close male relative. And after my guides went round and got provisions, we were going to visit one of the guides' families in a nearby village. We then headed off in another taxi and then walked about half a mile over fields into this tiny little village, which is probably about twice the size of this hall. And I met some real Afghan people. And it was quite interesting. They were a bit afraid of me at first. They were a bit wary. It was a time of war. Tensions were running high. But after, you know, they realized that I only had good intentions, they began coming out of their shell. And there was one young girl who came to me. She was in her 20s. And she was very, very sad. She said, you know, I should be in a hospital now, preparing to save people's lives. I was training to be a doctor when the Taliban closed down the medical school in Jalalabad. And she said, I feel really frustrated because my country's going to war and I feel so helpless. Then her elder brother came in, and he too had been training as a doctor. And he too had his training cut short because the same training school had closed down. So it wasn't just the women who were being affected, it was actually the men as well. And I felt very, very sad for these bright young people who had ambitions and careers that had just been cut suddenly. Then this very lively Afghan woman came in, and she looked me up and down, and she said, have you got any children? And I said, yes, I have one child, I've got a daughter. And she pushed me in a joking fashion. She was very strong. She actually sent me flying. And she said to me, you English and American women, you're all so pathetic. She said, all you can ever produce is one or two children. She said, me, I can produce 15. And when you run out of your boy soldiers, I will be producing more. So I was, you know, how do you feel about the thought of America going to war with you? She said, see those pots and pans over there? She said, if I have to use them on those soldiers, I will. We don't like any invaders in our country. And then they made a joke of how they'd kicked the British out the century earlier on two different occasions. And I asked them, why do you think America and Britain are going to bomb your country? And they were genuinely nonplussed by this. They said, well, we really don't know. We've heard about this mishap. And I kept hearing this word mishap. And that was the, basically, that is how the Afghans referred to 9/11, as a mishap. And I couldn't understand, you know, over 3,000 people died and you refer to it as a mishap. And then I realized, they had no televisions. They had no radio. The only form of real communication was from word of mouth. And so all the horrific images that we had seen unfold on our televisions, they could only hear about and imagine. They all lived in single-story homes. So trying to convey to them the full horror of someone throwing their body from the 100th floor of a building was very, very difficult for them to imagine. So they referred to it as the mishap. But they were totally confused about why the richest country in the world would want to bomb them, the poorest country in the world. They felt that they'd done nothing wrong, that they had nothing to do with this event, that they hadn't even watched on television, and so they were totally bemused by it. But like the lady with her pots and pans, they were all ready to put up a fight because, as America is beginning to learn to its cost, nobody likes an invading army in their country. After spending a day there, we headed back towards the Pakistan border, and Pakistan had just closed the gates at Torkham. They weren't letting anyone in. So we stayed the night in Afghanistan, and then the next day we went back down to the border. Pakistan had still sealed off the border. I'm not sure whether it was to stop fleeing families leaving Afghanistan with all their worldly goods to safety in Pakistan, or whether it was to stop the young men coming over the border to join the Taliban. But my guide said, well, we'll go through one of the smuggling routes. And I just imagined, you know, this smuggling route would be this narrow little path, and I'd be jumping from tree to tree and scurrying from a bush to another bush. And when we got to the smuggling route, it was really busy. There were camel traders, there were donkey drivers, there were lots of families fleeing Afghanistan, and as predicted, scores of young men coming over from Pakistan to offer their services to the Taliban. The Taliban recruiting officers were there. There was food being cooked, tea being served. It was a very, very lively place. By this time, I'd done a lot of walking, and my feet were beginning to cut and blister in the Afghan shoes I'd been wearing. And so one of my guides said, do you want to make the last part of the trip by donkey? It's only 10 minutes to the border. And I said, yeah, that's fine. And I looked at this donkey, and I thought, well, I can ride horses, you know, and it's more or less the same shape, and the head's more or less the same. Yes, yes, I'll be fine. Anyway, I got on this donkey. I don't know if it realized it had an infidel on its back or something happened, and the animal just bolted. And my arms and legs were waving as I'm trying to gain control of this animal, and the flapping of the burqa and my screams made it run even faster, and people were looking at this really bizarre sight. And just as I was trying to reach for the reins, the only piece of equipment I'd smuggled into Afghanistan was a camera, and the camera just fell from the folds of my burqa right into the passing view of a Taliban soldier. He just screamed, seeing this immediately, because cameras were banned under the Taliban. And I can't remember whether he stopped the donkey and I fell off, or whether he stopped the donkey and pulled me off. It was all very confusing and frightening. And as I stood looking at him, he's shouting at me in Pashto, and he obviously wants the camera. And so I removed the camera and handed it over to him. And at that moment, you know, I thought, this is it, I have been caught. And a lot of my friends said, what was going through your mind at that point? And I said, well, for a second, maybe a nanosecond, I looked at this guy and I thought, what a gorgeous looking man he is. He had the most amazing green eyes, high cheekbones, and a fantastic beard. But that was just for a nanosecond, and then the reality kicked in. Anyway, to my surprise, I obviously didn't have the same impact on him, because he just took the camera. He just took the camera and then went striding off. And he wanted to know who was in charge of this woman. So at this point, he actually didn't realize that I was a Westerner. And the man who'd hired the donkey pointed to one of my guides, and he went over and remonstrated with my guide. And there was quite a fierce row that was going on between the Taliban soldier and my guide. He smacked him across the face, and so the other guide became involved to try and cool the situation. And within minutes, a very heated discussion followed, and a lot of men crowded round. And before long, there were about 80 men shouting and screaming at my two guides, and the camera was being waved at them. And I noticed the rest of the party continuing towards the Pakistan border. So I went to follow them, and I looked round and saw these two guides looking very helpless in the middle of this melee. And I realized that I couldn't really leave them in that situation. So I went back and tried to push through the crowds, and I was immediately thrown back because this was very much man's business. It had nothing to do with a mere woman. And so there was nothing else for me to do other than to remove my burqa. I was wearing orange Afghan trousers and an orange dress. And I removed my burqa and said in a very loud voice, "Will someone let me through?" And it was like the parting of the Red Sea. These men just turned round and were quite gobsmacked at this sweaty, red-faced Westerner trying to pick a way through. But you see, I had a cunning plan. I thought that the Taliban soldier would be so delighted to get his hands on a Westerner, he would completely forget about my two guides. And as I walked towards the soldier, I looked at my guides. But as soon as I saw the look of horror on their faces, I realized that maybe it wasn't such a cunning plan after all. The three of us were rounded up and thrown into a car and were driven from this little area called Dawah Barba. And we were heading back to Jalalabad. And the driver and the Taliban soldier became very, very agitated, and they kept looking back at me and having these heated conversations and looking back, and suddenly the driver stopped the car and the soldier motioned for me to get out. He then led me to this raised piece of ground, and I guess what he was telling me was just to stand there and not move. So I did as I was told, naturally. You know, I'd just been captured by, as George Bush would tell us, the most evil, brutal regime in the world, and I was absolutely terrified. So I stood on this raised piece of ground, and very quickly a crowd of men gathered round. I mean, looking back, I suppose it must have been quite a funny sight, because all women wore burqas, and very few of them saw what women looked like other than their wife or a sister. So these guys, it was like looking at a panda in a zoo for the first time, and they kept getting closer and closer. But I didn't realize this. You know, I was just standing there as a terrified Westerner thinking, my God, this must be the stoning corner. Any minute now, they're going to pick up stones and start throwing them at me. And I looked down, and I'd lost my shoes and socks somewhere in this whole episode. And all I could see were blood-red toes standing, nail varnish coming back in my face. And I thought, oh no, nail varnish is banned as well. And I'm trying to curl my toes so they wouldn't see this nail varnish. And then I started looking round, trying to engage with somebody, find a friendly face in the crowd. And they were all very stern-looking, fierce-looking men who were just coming closer and closer. And I was just thinking, you know, these are the final seconds of my life. And I hope when they do decide to stone me that the first stone just knocks me out and I won't feel any pain. So as I'm standing there thinking that the final seconds of my life are ebbing away, the Taliban soldier returns again, and he has a woman wearing a burqa. She turns me round very roughly, and she started to frisk me. And all the fear and that I'd felt and the terror that I felt just swept away, and I just realized, oh, they think I'm carrying weapons. And so he's gone off to find a woman to search me. And I was so relieved. Then the relief suddenly turned to anger with the crowd of men, because I thought, you know, they frightened me so much, and I thought they were going to kill me. So I then turned round and shouted at the men. Now, I was wearing trousers at this point. And I went and shouted at the men, I am not carrying any weapons. And to emphasize it, I lifted my dress up like this and said, look. And there was a collective intake of breath, and then they all turned and ran like hell in the other direction. I don't know how many of you have seen the Carry On film, Carry On Up the Khyber, where the Scottish regiment lifts up its kilts and the natives run like mad, but it was just like that. So that was quite interesting. Of course, this was highly inappropriate behaviour for a woman, and so the woman in the burqa turned round and smacked me across the face. I was then put back in the car, and we headed towards Jalalabad. But of course, news had got round that they'd caught an American spy, and so we very soon had a convoy of excited young men firing their Kalashnikovs, shouting Amrika spy and Osama Zindabad, which is long live Osama. And they were so happy that they'd caught me, they stopped at every checkpoint so that everybody could come and have a look at this American spy. And I wound the window down at one checkpoint and said, I'm British. And then I thought, oh, well, we're about to bomb you as well, so maybe that's not such a good idea. And I remember seeing this little boy about my daughter's age then, about 8 or 9, and he pressed his face up close to the window so he could get a good look at this infidel. And he's looking really seriously at me. And I smiled at him and winked, and he just shook his head and went. So I thought, yes, he's probably right. I'm not going to see the sunset tonight. I was then taken into the intelligence headquarters in Jalalabad. And the head of intelligence understood a little bit of English. And I told him that I was very sorry for any inconvenience that he had caused. But would he give me the telephone so that I could ring home or ring my news editor just to tell them I'd got into a little bit of difficulty and I might be delayed 2 or 3 days. And he said, no, you can't use the telephone. And so this war of attrition then began. They took me into a room and they put some food out, and I said, I'm not eating any food until I use the telephone. And they were very, very distressed by this. I wasn't that hungry anyway, you know, having just been caught by the most evil, brutal regime in the world. And I said to the director of intelligence, I really need to use the telephone. I said, otherwise people in the West will think I'm hanging naked from that beam while you are whipping me. And he looked absolutely horrified. And he said, do you think we're monsters? And I said, well, have you any idea how you're portrayed in the West? And I told him and his colleagues, and they looked really upset and hurt. So this was quite strange as well. For the next 3 days, I continued my hunger strike. And despite this, every morning, noon, and night, they would bring me a meal. And they would also bring a jug of water and a bowl, and they would insist on washing my hands. And they would keep telling me that I was their guest. After the first day of refusing food, they brought the cook in, a little wizened man, and they said, tell this man why you won't eat his food. And he's looking at me pleading, you know, why won't you eat my food? Or that's what I think he was trying to say. And I had a translator at this point called Hamid, and I said, well, tell him that it's nothing personal, but until I get a telephone, I am not eating anything. The day after, they said, you won't eat our food because it's very poor. If we bring you hotel food, will you start eating it? And I said, just give me the telephone. And they said, no. And I said, well, that's my answer. By the third day, they were very frustrated by this behavior. And so they said, if we bring you wine, will you start eating food? And I thought wine was haram, it's banned, but it was okay because, you know, I was an infidel, she can have it. But I said, no, I need to use the telephone. That evening, the doctor came to examine me, although I was feeling perfectly fine, apart from the fact I was being held captive. And he checked my pulse, my eyes, you know, all the usual sort of MOT things that doctors do. And he took my blood pressure and he took it again and then he took it again. And I said to him, yes, I know I have high blood pressure. And he said, no, you don't. He said, it's normal. And so we had this argument over my blood pressure. And he took it again and he said, look. And I looked and I said, my goodness, you're right. I said, 3 days with the Taliban and you've cured my blood pressure. When he left, there were two Afghan journalists waiting for him to ask him how the English woman was. And what resulted was a story in the Jalalabad paper 2 days later. And the headline read, Yvonne Ridley is very happy and we've cured her blood pressure. Not the most catchy headline, but there you go. The level of questioning in the first 3 days was, who are you? Who is your father? Who is your father's father? And why did you come into our country? And this would be asked 9-10 times a day, and I'd have to write it all down. Now then, obviously, I would write my name down, I would put Alan Ridley for my father, but I had a problem with my father's father. My grandfather on my father's side was the black sheep of the family, so he was never discussed. He died long before I was born, and I really didn't know his name. So I put down Yvonne Ridley, Alan Ridley, Mr. Ridley. And one of them picked up on this after a while and he said, Mr. Ridley, what is his first name? And I said, I don't know. And it was, oh, she doesn't know her father's father. What sort of woman is this? What sort of family can she come from that she doesn't know her father's father? And they were very upset and distressed by this until I said, well, my father has 8 brothers and I know their names. Oh, good, write them down. So I wrote the names of my 8 uncles down. And this was the sort of level of questioning. And after about 10 times of being asked, why did you come into the country? They just wouldn't buy the fact that I was a journalist. I said, okay, I'll put my hands up, I'll tell you the truth. And they all leaned forward to hear this revelation. They'd finally broken me. They wanted, you know, they were going to find out why I'd come into their country. And I said, I came into your country to join the Taliban. And they laughed. And I thought, well, this is a good sign. The most evil, brutal regime in the world has a sense of humor as well. So this isn't too bad. The fourth day they ignored me, which was very frightening. It was more frightening than not being questioned because I just thought, well, they've obviously decided that I'm guilty of something and that they're going to do something so horrible to me that they just don't want to even talk to me anymore. Then on the fifth day, they came in with a file and they looked very triumphant and very pleased with themselves. And they said, we want you to write down your tax returns, your property tax, your inland revenue payments, your health tax. It was unbelievable, this thought, you know, suddenly it had gone from who is your father's father to how much tax do you pay? And I just couldn't understand this. What I was to discover 2 weeks later after I'd been released was that they had been given a bogus intelligence file, which made me look as though I was some sort of female equivalent to James Bond. Then they went away with all these facts and figures that I'd given them. Then they returned and they said, "You have lied to us." And I said, "Everything I have told you, you know, I've told you the truth." And they said, "Well, you didn't tell us you had a daughter." And I said, "Well, you never asked." And they said, "Yes, but you said you were single." I said, "I am single." And one of them shouted, "How can you be single and you've got a daughter?" So I went through the concept of divorce and separation, and they accepted that. And after the next day, Hamid, the translator, came in, and his face was nearly black with fear, and he could hardly talk. It was as though he had a mouthful of feathers, and he said, "You have a very, very important visitor. You must be respectful." And I'm thinking, well, who is it? You know, we've had all the intelligence people in, we've had the head of intelligence, we've seen the commander of this, you know, and he's going, "Just please, please be respectful." And I'm wondering, maybe it's going to be Mullah Omar, you know, who knows? Anyway, Hamid went away and he came back and he knocked on the door. They always knocked on my door, they never came in until I said enter. So I opened the door and Hamid moved aside, and there standing in front of me was this tall man. And he had an immaculate ivory gown on. Everything in Afghanistan is dirty and raggy, and there he was in this immaculate ivory gown and this great big ivory turban. And he had beads, and he was moving them two at a time, and he had this smile on his face. His face was also shining, and I couldn't understand it. I said to friends later, if we hadn't been in Afghanistan, I would have swore that he'd just come out of a TV studio. But I was later to learn, when I got back to Britain and spoke to Muslims, that this is the Noor. It was quite surprising, this light that, as I say, was shining from him. Anyway, I took one look at him and I just thought, oh no, it's the God Squad. I have avoided talking about religion for 6 days. Now I'm being confronted with this cleric. And I thought, no wonder Hamid is nervous. You know, I'm nervous now. And I invited him in. And this guy didn't even walk. He just glided. And he glided in and glided down. And I went after him and sat opposite him. And he's moving his beads two at a time, and he's smiling. And through Hamid, he said, "What religion are you?" And I thought, here we go. I said, "I'm a Christian." "Yes, yes, but what sort of Christian? Are you a Roman Catholic? Are you a Protestant?" I said, "I'm a Protestant from the Church of England." And he nodded, and still smiling and moving his beads, and he said, "And what do you think of Islam?" "Oh," I said, "it's wonderful, absolutely fantastic." I said, "Do you know," I said, they are so passionate about their faith round here, they pray 5 times a day. And he's smiling and he said, "Islam is a beautiful religion." I said, "Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more." And he said, "So, you would like to convert?" And I thought, he's led me right into a cul-de-sac here. If I say yes, he'll say, "You insincere, fickle woman." If I say no, he'll accuse me of insulting Islam. Either way, I'm going to be taken away and stoned. So I'm looking at him, and in the end, I said, "You know, thank you very, very much for your really kind offer, but I can't possibly make such a life-changing decision while I'm in prison. However, if you let me go, I promise I will read the Quran and study Islam when I get back to the UK. And he just looked and he smiled and he rose up and glided out. And I never saw him again. I don't know who he is, From the description I've given to friends, they think he may have been Chechnyan. We just don't know. And so he went. Hamid returned 10 minutes later and he said, "You're going home." And I thought, yes. And he said, "You're going home in a Red Crescent plane. And there's a car waiting for you, and you're going, and, you know, goodbye." So I was really, really pleased, and I congratulated myself for being so clever with this cleric, and I thought, yes, you know, I've talked my way out of this one. They know I'm innocent, and I'm going home. There's a trait that the Afghans have that I hadn't realized at that point, and it's quite an endearing quality, really. They don't like giving bad news. They will tell you anything rather than tell you something that is going to cause you distress or alarm. So I got in this car, and I'm being driven up to Kabul, and I'm thinking, I'm going home on a Red Crescent plane. I'm sure there could be a song to this. And we drove straight past the airport, but I was quite relaxed. I knew that there were other Westerners being held in Afghanistan, and maybe we're picking them up. Maybe we're all going home on a Red Crescent plane. We then pulled into a prison, and I'm still upbeat, thinking, well, we're obviously picking them up. And then they asked me to get out, and I thought, well, I'd like to see the inside of an Afghan prison anyway. I'm not staying long. I'm going home on a Red Crescent plane. And we went into this very dingy prison wing, and they opened this prison door and into this cell. And there, sitting on a concrete floor, was a heavily pregnant Afghan woman, another Afghan woman, and a child that looked about 2 years old. And I said, yes. I said, what do you want? And he said, one of them said, you're staying here tonight. And I said, no, you've got it all wrong. I'm going home on a Red Crescent plane. He said, no, you were a very bad woman. You have done wrong. You came into our country without a passport and visa, and you are going to prison. And I couldn't believe it. I started screaming and shouting, you've lied to me. I can't trust you. Your words are dust. How dare you do this to me? You can't do this. I'm British, which always raises a smile. And I was really shouting at the top of my voice, and this other prison door opened, and these six women came out wearing hijabs. And one of them said to me, in an Australian voice, she said, are you from the Red Cross? And I said, who do you know from the Red Cross that screams and shouts and curses like that? And then I said, you speak my language. And she said, oh, I'm Australian. These two are Americans. These three are Germans. And I went, oh, my God, you're the Christians. You've been trying to convert Muslims to Christianity, and you're facing trial. And they said, yes, that's us. And I said, right, will you tell these men I am not staying in prison. I refuse to stay in prison. I am going home on a Red Crescent plane. They looked at me, and they started communicating in Pashto, and it became quite obvious that I wasn't going anywhere that night. So the women said, why don't you stay in our cell, and you know, until the morning, and then we'll get this sorted out. And I hadn't had any female company for over 6 days, and they understood my language, and I thought, well, this will be an experience, and it'll be another story to write, and I'll find out what's going on in their lives. So I said, yes, okay. When I walked into their tiny little cramped cell, it was just very upset and started to cry. And as the tears were coming down, I said, you know, they've lied to me, and they've finally broken me. I've been trying to keep strong for 6 days, but now, you know, I'm deeper into Afghanistan. I'm just never going to get out of this place. And I was really sobbing, and I went to reach for my cigarettes, and I was just about to light up, and I said, does anybody mind if I smoke? And they all said, yes, this is a no-smoking cell. Lord, what sort of Christians are these? They can see I'm really distressed. And how come I find the only no-smoking cell in Asia? They said, you can go outside and smoke. We're just about to have a meeting. And I said, a meeting? They said, oh, yes, we have two meetings a day. And I thought, oh, I wonder, you know, what happens around here that they can talk for two meetings a day? Maybe it's the escape committee. Maybe they're digging a tunnel. So I said, do you mind if I sit in? And they said, no, not at all. And so I was waiting to hear of daring do's and tunnels being dug and escape plans being hatched. And they sat in a circle and they all got out Bibles. And I'm looking at the door thinking, any minute now the Taliban are going to come rushing in. These women are in serious trouble already. And now they're just openly reading from the Bible. And they read from the Bible out loud for about 20 minutes. And then they handed round sheets of paper, and they gave me this sheet of paper, and they started singing. And it was very loud, happy, clappy, evangelical, robust, you know, Jesus wants me for a sunbeam songs. And I was horrified. I just thought, I can't believe, you know, that I've been locked up with a bunch of Christian fundamentalists. I mean, the Taliban had banned music, and I was eternally grateful to discover later that they had confiscated their tambourines and guitars. So there's all this very loud, happy, clappy singing going on, and at that point I went into the courtyard and smoked three cigarettes off the trot, and the call for prayer came up. And the call for prayer is coming up, and this happy, clappy Jesus singing. And I just thought, you know, I felt as though I'd been caught up in an Andy Warhol movie. I just didn't know what to make of this. And I started laughing to myself when I was thinking of my friends who would be imagining all sorts of tortures. But the one torture that they wouldn't imagine that I was going through was that I'd be sharing a cell with six Christian evangelicals. The next morning, one of the girls, I mean, they were lovely girls, by the way, one of the girls gave me a change of clothes, and I was able to wash my shalwar kameez and my underwear. And I hung it up on the washing line in the courtyard of the women's prison. And the prison governor came running down, and he said, remove those garments. And I said, you know, it's my washing and I'm waiting for it to dry. He said, well, cover them up. Put a towel over them. And I said, you foolish man. I said, you've obviously never done the washing in your life. How on earth is anything going to dry underneath a towel? You know, no, I'm not. I'm leaving my clothes there. And I said, what is the problem? And he said, those. And he pointed to a big pair of black knickers. Nothing salacious or lacy, just sensible knickknacks. So I said, I'm leaving them there. And he said, you have to take them down. And I said, this is the woman's prison. If you don't like it, you can leave. And he's saying, look, my Taliban soldiers are upstairs, and if they look out of the window, they'll see those things on the line. And I said, well, tell them not to look out of the window for the next hour. He went away, and I thought that was the end of the matter. Then he came back with a senior officer from the foreign ministry. This was rapidly turning into an international incident. And they said, you have to remove those undergarments. And I said, I'm not. You know, they're drying. And this argument developed why on earth they couldn't just pull them off themselves. In fact, I invited the prison governor, if you find them so offensive, take them down yourself. And he looked horrified at the thought he might have to touch my underwear. Then the man from the foreign ministry tried to explain to me, look, those undergarments will give our soldiers impure thoughts. And I said, if your soldiers get turned on by my big black knickers, then there's something sadly wrong. So this war continued, and in the end, by the time we'd finished arguing, they were dry anyway and they were removed. But I began to think about this, and I'm thinking, you know, the most evil, brutal regime in the world. They ran a mile when I lifted up my skirt. They wouldn't search me, even though they thought I was carrying weapons. They found a woman to search me. The sight of my underwear put them into a flat spin. And I thought, you know, America and Britain doesn't need to drop bombs on this country. We just need a few women waving their knickers and they'll go. Certainly not the image that Bush and Blair were creating back home as they were trying to whip up this storm that this is the most evil, brutal regime in the world. I don't know whether they thought I was having a bad effect on the Christians, who were all model prisoners and got on very well with their Taliban captors, but they decided to remove me and they put me upstairs in the Taliban sleeping quarters, where one of the officers vacated his room, and I had a very nice room by Afghan standards. And they said, tomorrow you will go home. Now, they had been saying this from the day that I had been arrested. Tomorrow you will go home. And they used to use this word at the end of every sentence, and I didn't know what it meant then. It was, tomorrow you will go home, inshallah. And I would say, don't you inshallah me. What is this inshallah? And they said, on the 7th of October, tomorrow you will go home, inshallah. And I'm going, yes, yes, I've heard it all before. Instead of investigating my surroundings, I had got engrossed in a novel, Ken Follett's From Code to Zero. If you ever get locked up, I can thoroughly recommend it. And I was engrossed in this book and smoking away like fag ash lil, when suddenly there was this huge rip outside and the sky just went white. And I went running to the window, which looked up to Kabul Hill, and I realized that the war had started. And for the next 40 minutes, Britain and America dropped 50 cruise missiles on the capital. And you can hear a cruise missile land from 20 miles away. These were coming within a quarter of a mile of the prison. I was really scared, terrified. I thought, you know, if the Taliban don't get me, the British bombs will. And it was why it had never occurred to me before when I'd covered wars, I don't know, but I suddenly realized then and there, these bombs can't discriminate. They can't tell the difference between military, civilian, man or woman or child, military target, hospital, prison. And it was a terrible, terrible 40 minutes. And when it all finished, I thought, well, that's it. The war has started and I am never going to get out of here. There is no way the Taliban will release me tomorrow. But the next morning they came and they said, you are going home. There was no inshallah, it was a, you are going home. And they escorted me out and put me into a people carrier. And they drove me down to the Pakistan border. And when I got out and was told I was free, I walked towards some Pakistan officials and these camera lights just hit me and I couldn't see anything, I was blinded, but I heard somebody say, how are you feeling? And I said, I'm fine. And then somebody else said, how did the Taliban treat you? And I thought about it and I'd been really mean and horrible and aggressive with them. I'd spat at them, I'd cursed them, I'd swore at them, and all they did was return my insults with kindness or keep saying, you know, why are you angry? You're our sister, you're our guest, we want you to be happy. So how did the Taliban treat you? And I said, they treated me with respect and courtesy. Well, apparently those three words, respect and courtesy, caused a huge spin back in among the Western media, who were trying to second guess what I was going to say. And there were headline writers who'd even had rape, abuse and torture in the headlines. And of course they had to rip it out. Everybody wanted a victim. They wanted me to come back with tales of how my nails had been ripped out, how I'd been gang raped, how I'd been attacked, how I'd been shot at. And of course there was nothing like that had happened to me. They never threatened me. The worst threat I ever got was one officer saying, if you don't tell us the truth, you will be in here for 20 years. And I said to him, you will get sick long before I do. But this is not what the West wanted to hear, because after all, you can't drop bombs on nice people. And so quite a few people and British politicians as well were furious when I came out and said that. But it was the truth. After I returned to England, I thought about what had happened and thought about the Christians still being inside and how, against all the odds, I had been released. And then I remembered the conversation I'd had with the cleric, and I said, well, they did keep their word, and so really I should keep mine. And so I rang a couple of Muslim colleges and had a meeting with a couple of academics and said I wanted to start reading the Quran, and how do I go about it? And I was given a beautiful copy of the Quran with an index in the back, so I started looking through all the women's issues, because I wanted to know what is in this book that promotes the subjugation and oppression of women. And as I was reading through, the Quran, as most of you already know, makes it crystal clear that women are equal in spirituality, worth and education. And furthermore, we're praised for our child-rearing and childbirth capabilities. So I'm thinking, you know, not only is this book saying we're equal, it's actually saying that women are the deluxe model of the human being. And so I then looked into divorce rights, property rights, inheritance rights, things that have only come into the arena of the Western woman in the last 100 years. And then I began to realize that, you know, If this book is really practiced, the women's liberation movement didn't start in the 1960s. It actually started 1400 years ago in the Quran. Of course, the proof is in the pudding, so I then went out and started talking to the Muslim community, and in particular the sisters. And wherever I went, I was really inspired by them, and far from being subjugated and oppressed, I found highly politicized, intelligent, switched on women. And I realized that their brand of sisterhood made Western feminism pale into insignificance. You know, that they all helped each other and pulled each other up and pushed each other up, and whether they were educated formally or not, they all helped in whatever way they could, and I was just so impressed by this. Then the more I began reading, the more I realized that the Quran is a book of peace and has promoted far many more scholars and poets and artists than it ever has warriors. And I just couldn't believe it. I wanted to go running back into Afghanistan and say, hey guys, you know, have you read this? I couldn't find anything about knickers on the washing line, but it was everything that I read was just so inspiring. It was so relevant to today. It could have been written yesterday. And the other thing that I discovered about the Muslim community is what an effective gossipy network it's got. You can do something in Glasgow in the morning and someone from Karachi will ring you in the afternoon and say, oh, we hear that you enjoyed your lunch or that you did this. And so it spread through the community like wildfire. Yvonne Ridley is reading the Quran and it's turning into a spiritual journey. And there were a few false rumors. Oh, she's taking her Shahada. And I got a phone call this day from a colorful member of the Muslim community in London called Sheikh Abu Hamza al-Masri. I don't know if you've heard of the brother. He lost both his arms in Afghanistan a few years ago and the sight of one eye. And he's under considerable pressure by the British authorities at the moment. And he rang me up and he said, Sister Yvonne, congratulations, I hear you've embraced Islam. I said, oh, I'm really sorry, you're a wee bit premature. I'm nearly there, but not quite. But thank you for showing an interest. And he said, we're all interested. We will all support you. We will all help you. You just pick up the phone any time. Don't rush into this, you just take your time. There is a big community out there and we're all willing that you will one day make the right decision, inshallah. And I thought, I can't believe this. You know, this is the notorious cleric from Finsbury Park Mosque, the fire and brimstone cleric. And he's been really nice. And I said, well, you know, thank you so much for your kindness and support. And he said, oh, it's okay. He said, but I just want you to know one thing. He said, if you have an accident tomorrow and you die, you'll go straight to hellfire. So I thought about what he said. And I got a copy of the Shahada and I put it in my purse and I carried it around with me for some considerable time. And when I told Muslims, I would say, you know, if you come across an accident and somebody is shouting for two Muslim witnesses, you'll know it's me because, you know, I've had an accident. Anyway, I can happily say that there was no such accident, but on June the 30th last year at 11 a.m., I took my Shahada. And I joined what I consider to be the biggest supportive family in the world. I know that wherever I go, I'll have brothers and sisters who are there for me. And as I say, it was just an absolutely wonderful, tremendous feeling. I know I'll never be lonely again. And, you know, I'm still very much on this journey and I can see, you know, it's going to take a lifetime of learning. What I need to do now is to learn Arabic to really appreciate the beauty of the Quran. But I just thought that, you know, I would share that with you this evening. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm sure that there are many of you that will want to ask questions. Some of you might just want to write them down. Others might want to just stick your hand up. And I think it would be nice if we had a question and answer session. I'm not sure how much time we've got left. But just before I started, the Mufti of Australia was saying, your story would make a great movie. And I was saying that I did actually have a phone call from a Hollywood producer who'd read my book, In the Hands of the Taliban. And she said, you know, this is an amazing story. It will make a great film. I can't do the American accent, but she was very, very excited about it. And she said, I read that the Taliban had actually bought you or given you a wedding dress. And she said, as though you would marry one of those dirty, filthy, stinking Arabs. And I said, they weren't dirty, filthy, stinking Arabs, as you call them. They were from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and they were remarkably handsome young men. And she's going, really? And I said, yes. And I said, if you'd read my book properly, you'd realize that the only dirty, filthy, stinking Arab in it is the father of my daughter. Thank you and good night. So I'm afraid Hollywood called, but I put the phone down. And I'm having seen the mess that that they've made of some films. I'm glad that I did. Someone's asking me, as a captive, were you surprised with the way the Taliban treated you, especially after the way they were betrayed in the West? I was absolutely amazed because, you know, I had bought into that propaganda that they were the most evil, brutal regime in the world. And I remember Tony Blair saying, these people are so evil, they have banned their children from doing simple pleasures like flying kites. And so during a lighter moment, during questioning, I asked them, I said, you know, why have you banned children from flying kites? And they looked puzzled and said, well, we've stopped them from flying kites in built-up areas in the towns and cities because they wrap the kites around the wires, they get electrocuted, they die, the areas without power, and you know, but you know, they can fly kites in the countryside. And I thought about this, and I thought, I'd like to know how far I would get up Oxford Street in London when all the Christmas lights are up flying a kite. I would be arrested immediately. So, you know, we have to be very careful when leaders stand up and start to demonize countries and its citizens. Where do you think feminism fits in Islam? Well, I had an interesting talk in Melbourne earlier this week, and one woman who was very strong in the feminist movement in the 60s accused me of betraying my sex. And I said to her, you know, just please read the Quran and make up your own mind. You know, read the book before you make snap judgments. And she said, yes, but, you know, look at Muslim women, they're covered up. And I know that the hijab is an obligation, and, you know, I will get there one day, and I will make that commitment, but I'm just not ready to yet. And she said, you know, she was talking about this head covering, and I said, look, the hijab is part of a Muslim woman's uniform. It's part of her business suit. It says, I am a Muslim woman, and therefore you will treat me with respect. And I said, that is what the hijab is saying, and that is the message that it gives out to people. And I know that I miss out by not wearing the hijab, because when I'm walking down a street and I'll see some sisters approaching, I'm sort of smiling at them and wanting to give salams, and of course they're looking, thinking, what on earth is wrong with that woman? Whereas if I was wearing the hijab, we'd pass salam and move on, but, you know, that connection would have been made. And I said, can you imagine telling a businessman in the city or a banker, get out of your suit and put on t-shirts and jeans and just chill out? He would say, how dare you? My clothes tell you who I am and what I stand for, just in the same way as the hijab does. And then I said to her, you know, if you see the hijab as such a threat, you know, maybe we should storm the Vatican and liberate all those nuns that dress up like penguins, you know, and you know, are they oppressed? Are they subjugated? Oh, well, that's different. How? So we've got a lot of educating to do, and, you know, I feel very guilty about the past, because, you know, if I saw some Muslim sisters walking down the street, I would think the same as this woman did. And, of course, I've been totally wrong, and if anyone was wearing a veil, it was me, and it was a veil of ignorance and bigotry. There's a question here about the amount of British whites who've embraced Islam, and some high-profile figures that have embraced Islam. There have been 14,000 converts to Islam in Britain since September 11, and that's official. And the so the statisticians have been working away very closely on these figures, and they've looked at the amount of Christians who they describe as practicing Christians. And to be a practicing Christian, you have to go to church once a week, as far as this survey is concerned. There are just over 1 million practicing Christians in Britain today, and there are just under 1 million practicing Muslims in Britain today. And they reckon within the next 5 years that Islam will become the number one faith in Britain. So that's very interesting. What do I think about Al-Qaeda? I don't even know if it exists. That is the reality. The Western intelligence forces tell us that it exists, and they... I was watching the TV tonight with intelligence chiefs in Australia jumping up and down saying, we're going to be next from Madrid. But of course, what you've got to remember, all these intelligence chiefs and police chiefs, they all have budgets. And the more fear that they can put into the community, the bigger the budget they'll get. So they have a vested interest in getting us all into a flat spin. Let's see. Why do journalists always portray Islam in a negative viewpoint? Is it a code of conduct? No, a lot of it is just down to... there is some Islamophobia in the media, but there's also a huge amount of ignorance. And what I'm trying to do... in the UK is to get journalism schools to spend a day, maybe 2 days, with would-be journalists just to discuss Islam with them so that they don't make any basic errors. About 5 weeks ago, there was a front page story in the Sunday Times which said that British police had arrested an Algerian who was obviously going out on a suicide operation in Britain, but they didn't have enough evidence, and so they had to let him go. And then they quoted a British intelligence source as saying he was quite clearly ready for a martyrdom operation because he'd shaved his body hair. You know, on that grounds, about 2 million Muslims in Britain are ready to go Shaheed. But it's that sort of ignorance which is frustrating. And I think that what we've got to do is start to adopt a zero-tolerance stance. And if you see anything that's wrong, offensive or misinformed, write in and correct it, whether it's radio, TV or print. And I think, you know, that we're all going to have to adopt this zero-tolerance attitude, and also adopt it in every other point of life as well. If someone makes fun of you or threatens you or pulls your hijab or makes fun of your religion, you know, instead of responding to them, I think you should report it to the police and you know, create a bit of paperwork in our favour instead of the other way around. How did your family and friends react when you told them you were converting to Islam? Well, one of my sisters lives next door to a Muslim family, so she knew I wasn't going to become the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. The other sister has had no contact with the Muslim community at all, and she thinks I'm going off to become a suicide bomber. My mother was so distraught, she started going to church again. And I said to her, I said, you see, already Islam is having a very positive effect on your life. At least you're getting some spirituality back into it. And I happen to believe, anyway, that Christianity is an excellent springboard to Islam. And there was I was given a great explanation one day about Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And this brother said, if you had three memos from your boss, which memo would you take notice of? And I said, well, the most up-to-date one, the final one. And he said, that is Islam. And it's a very simple explanation, but it's so right. If you were given a chance to go back to Afghanistan and live under the Taliban, will you go? I might, but I don't think they would have me back. When I was being released, Mullah Zaif, the Taliban ambassador, made a press conference. And he said, we are letting the English woman go. She's a horrible woman and she has a bad mouth. And we will be glad to see the back of her. Mullah Zaif, by the way, is in Camp Delta. You know, this is the way Americans treat international diplomats. But I'm told that he is in good spirits and that he does lead the prayers. Do you think that the Taliban were behind September 11? No. I don't think that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are two separate things. And I don't think that the Taliban had any idea about September 11. And while I can't sanitize them and hold them up as a fantastic example of a ruling government, what I can say is that they were demonized beyond recognition. Can you tell us about the reception as a journalist after you converted? A lot of my work dropped off, but it started to come back again now that they realize that I'm still the same person and I can still write and I can still bring good stories. Before you went to Afghanistan, what did you really think of Muslims? I've often sort of looked back and try and think of a defining moment where I was told that Muslims were oppressed and subjugated, or that it was a violent faith. But everything that I can't put my finger on one thing, and I think a lot of it is subliminal. And I remember doing the Crusades for history at school. And of course, at our school, we were told that the Crusaders were the good guys. I've looked back into history about the Crusades, and I realized, you know, that they were a cutthroat bunch of mercenaries. Maybe, you know, that Islam has been demonized right from the days of the Crusades, and very, very effectively. How do you feel about the West's misinterpretation of Islam and Muslims, and why do you think the West does that? Do you think it's deliberate? Of course it's deliberate. I was giving a talk earlier today exactly about this. George Bush, his rhetoric is not accidental. There's nothing accidental or a slip of the tongue when he starts talking about crusades and crusaders. He knows exactly what he's saying. And then he feigns interest in Islam and says that he's interested in the Muslim community and that he has read the Quran and he respects Islam. And then he goes and gets somebody like the Reverend Franklin Graham to conduct the Easter service at the Pentagon, a man who stood up and said Islam is evil. There's a statistic, I'm just trying to find it at the moment, which probably explains why. By 2010, the Muslim world will control 60% of the world's oil production and 95% of the remaining global oil export capacity. That must terrify the life out of the Americans. And so what they need to do is they need to control. So what they do is they install puppet regimes. I mean, we've seen what's happened in Afghanistan. Afghanistan wasn't about getting Osama bin Laden. Afghanistan was about seizing control so they can put an oil pipeline 420 miles long in one part of the country through to the other. And, you know, America is not a nation builder. Afghanistan is in a dreadful state. Hamid Karzai is known as the mayor of Kabul because he's totally lost power outside of the capital. He can't even rely on Afghans to look after him. His bodyguards are American. There are more than 10,000 American soldiers in Afghanistan at the moment. They're not part of the peacekeeping force. They're committing atrocities and war crimes, and they're literally getting away with murder because they can. Because America's refused to sign up to any international war crimes tribunal. On my last trip to Afghanistan last year, I actually went undercover again. I didn't put on the burqa, but I was undercover, not to hide from the Taliban, but to hide from American special forces, because I did an expose on some of the atrocities that they're getting up to in Afghanistan. I went down into Paktika, where there's quite a bit of firefighting between the Taliban and American special forces. And while I was there, they sent a laser-guided missile into a family home. And when the villagers near the border, Pakistan-Afghan border of Shkin, went to try and put out the fire, and they could hear children crying, they were beaten back by the American soldiers, and they were told this is a Taliban stronghold. By the morning, they pulled out the bodies of 11 children. Nobody else, 11 children, died in that attack. One woman, I'll be haunted by her image forever, lost all her 9 children. Her sister-in-law lost 2 of her children. The American commander returned 2 days later, very brave man. He turned up with 50 armed guards, and he apologized to the 2 fathers of the dead children, and he handed over 500,000 Afghani notes, which is the equivalent of less than $1,000 per child. So now we know what an Afghan life is worth. They are really a disgusting, contemptible lot. They've outstayed their welcome in Afghanistan. And the Taliban are now fighting them on their terms. I mean, when I was held, they were telling me how they were looking forward to this fight with the American chocolate soldiers, as they called them, and they said, we're going to grab their shiny new weapons. And I said, well, I'm not sure that you'll see any American soldiers when the war starts, because America no longer sends its people in by foot. And they said, no, we'll have a really good fight. And that's why the Taliban fell away so quickly, because, you know, you can't have a fight with a B-52 bomber. So they, you know, they just packed in and left, and now they're regrouping and having quite a few serious firefights with the Americans, and are causing them all sorts of problems. And I really can't see how 19 brothers turned up at the airport on time with their tickets, catching the right planes, hitting the right targets. And then you wonder about this meeting, you know, that the brothers had, and how could 19 brothers agree on which planes to catch, which targets to hit, when to do it, how to do it. So, you know, there's still a huge question mark over 9/11, and I don't think we've seen any conclusive proof yet of actually who is behind it.